Today is Monday, January 4th, 2010. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with Matt Mendenhall, associate editor of Birders World magazine. We'll talk about whooping cranes, what makes them special, how they're making a comeback from a population of just 16 birds, and how scientists have taught them to migrate using ultralight planes. But first, let me play you today's creature call. For this week's creature call, I'll move to the Midwest United States, where a group of dedicated scientists are saving these endangered birds from extinction. Now, listen carefully and see if you can guess today's creature call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again, tell you what kind of animal made them, and also give you a preview of next week's creature call. Now, let me turn to my conversation on whooping cranes with Matt Mendenhall. Mr. Mendenhall is associate editor of Birders World magazine. He has written about all sorts of birds, from the common northern cardinal and varied thrush to the endangered whooping crane and California condor to the presumably extinct imperial woodpecker. He grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and is a graduate of the journalism program at Marquette University. When we talked just before the holidays, I asked Matt what first got him interested in whooping cranes.
I joined the magazine in 2000, and that was right about the time, and we're based here in Milwaukee, just outside in Wisconsin. And in just around that time, a whooping crane project got going here in central Wisconsin, and so we decided that we were going to cover this project as well as we could, because whooping cranes are intensely interesting to birders just because they're so rare. And I was also got interested on a more personal level from a speech in 2001 by George Archibald. If your listeners are at all familiar with bird conservation or wildlife conservation, they most likely know his name.
Who is George Archibald?
He's the co-founder of the International Crane Foundation, which is here in Wisconsin. And he spoke at a birding festival that we co-hosted back in 2001. And he's such a dynamic speaker and gave this great talk about how important cranes are in all around the world to various cultures and the work of saving cranes goes a long way towards saving wetlands and all kinds of other animals and birds.
And how important are cranes all around the world? What is so important about cranes?
Well, they're very tall birds. They're some of the tallest birds in the world, and so they're beautiful. Many of them are white. And have the whooping crane is snow white bird, and they have incredible calls, these loud calls that keep pairs together, and so you can't help but notice them, and people in other countries, Japan and Korea and other parts of the world sort of revere cranes in some ways. They're just magnificent animals that are people just can't help but get enough of them.
You often see them as a symbol of peace.
Symbols of peace is one of the important part of their story, because they are found on actually in present day they're found in the demilitarized zone between the North and South Korea, and one of the reasons for keeping the demilitarized zone wild has been the presence of several species of cranes in that area.
So they're a literal as well as figurative.
Absolutely,
symbol of peace.
Right.
So tell me about whooping cranes. Like, I've never seen a whooping crane, and
okay.
I know it's the tallest North American bird.
It is the tallest North American bird. It's about 4.5 to 5 feet tall. Snow white over most of its body. It has black wingtips, and the crown on the top of the head is actually bare of feathers. It's a red, red-colored crown. It has a very long, powerful bill.
Like, how long is its bill?
Probably a little bit longer than your hand. It's very strong. In fact, I've heard that folks, if folks get too close, they wouldn't, a crane wouldn't slow down to attack you with its bill. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, they could do some damage. So they're
and where do they live?
Well, the only natural wild population spends the winters at Aransas National Wildlife Refuge on the coast of Texas, and then it migrates to Wood Buffalo National Park, which is a very large national park up in north central Canada, and they breed in that park and then fly back down south again to Texas in the fall. And that population is the last remaining wild population. It was down to about 15 or 16 individuals back in the 1940s, and it has slowly come back over the years, and it's currently numbers about 245 or so. So they're one of the rarest birds in North America, in the United States and Canada, not counting Hawaii. I think they're the species with the second fewest number of birds.
So it lives on the coast of Texas in the winter.
The winter, right.
And then migrates up north in northern Canada.
Yep.
In the summer.
It migrates through all the central states. It stops in Kansas, Nebraska. There's a major sandhill crane migration stop in central Nebraska, and whooping cranes sometimes will show up there on their way north, but they're obviously much fewer in number than sandhills. So it's a pretty special treat for folks who are watching sandhills to see hoopers there.
And now, sandhills are the only other North American crane species, is
correct.
That right?
Yeah, that's correct. They're
And what do they look like just by comparison to these?
By comparison, they're a little bit shorter, maybe 4 feet tall or so, and they're more gray in color, with the red crown again, and have some, depending on the subspecies, they have some rusty colors in their feathers. And they're much more widespread. They're about 500,000 or so of sandhill cranes in North America. And so the number of crane species around the world, there are about 15 around the world, and the sandhill and the whoopers are the only two in North America. And the whooper is the most endangered of all the crane species.
And how did it get endangered? Why did it, if you only had 15 or 16 individuals, why so few? What happened?
Well, it's thought that perhaps in the 1500s or so, back in before European settlement, there may have been as many as 10,000 whoopers. And by the 1870s or so, the number may have been down to about 1,300 or 1,400.
Feathers?
Hunting most likely for their meat was part of the issue and part of the reason that they declined. And then they're birds of the tallgrass prairie, and as the tallgrass prairie was converted to farmland, their habitat in large part was wiped out. And so this small population hung on, nesting very far north, away from anywhere, away from any place that anyone else had known that they existed, into the 30s and 40s. And finally, that the nesting ground actually wasn't even discovered until 1954, I think.
Wow. And what do they need to nest?
This particular population nests in a wetland habitat. They nest in marshes, and they need open space and lots of area, lots of water around. Birds generally build pretty large nests that are sort of surrounded by water, not very deep water, but still,
So is their nest like an island, or it's on like a little...
It's sort of like an island, yeah. It's not generally not built on land, but they sort of build it up with plant materials. They generally lay two eggs, and then usually just one of the chicks survives.
How big are their nests, and how big are the eggs?
The eggs are, say, about 4 inches long, and they're beige and brown in color, sort of matching the color of the plant material that they generally build the nest with. I believe the nest may be about 3 or 4 feet wide, I'd say. Can't say for sure on that, but.
And then, do they have to sit on it all day, or do they just hide the nest? Or,
no, they're.
And is it the males or females that?
I believe they. I believe they switch off. They'll one will go get food, and then the other one will sit on the nest, and then they'll switch and take turns watching.
So sort of
the
an
nest.
Equitable relationship.
Yeah, right. They're not not like songbirds or some other family where the male just takes off.
And do the males look just like the females, or are the males more brighter white? Or
No, they're generally they're same appearance. I think the males are just a little bit taller.
So do they have any predators? I mean, being white, you'd think they'd be pretty easy to see.
Right, and they are easy to see, and they're sort of made to be easy to see, I guess, because or they don't. Maybe they don't. In some ways, maybe they don't mind it because they are so tall, and they've got this big bright red patch on their heads. They're sort of the bullies of the marsh.
Really? And, why do you say that?
Well, they who's going to mess with a animal that's that tall and has this huge long bill that poke your eye out?
And does anybody try, or they just know from looking?
No, they do. Yeah, coyotes and other animals might try to get them, and bald eagles or other large predatory birds might come after the young.
Oh, really?
So yeah, they do have their predators. And of course, the big problem for especially the wild population that goes between Canada and Texas are power lines. Birds.
Oh, tell
me. Don't really see them when they're flying, and then they can just fly right into them, and they often just die from hitting power lines.
Really?
Yeah.
Is there a way to stop that by marking the power lines along their route?
I know that's been tried, and I think it has been somewhat successful, but I don't know how. I think it would take a lot to mark every single power line.
And that's an issue not just for the whooping crane, but for a lot of migratory bird species.
Yeah, absolutely. Those lines are fairly thin, and birds just don't see them, especially if the light isn't good enough to see.
When they migrate, are they usually flying during the day or during the nighttime?
No, during the day, they'll generally ride up on thermal air spools, sort of like hawks do, and fly really high up over the landscape and just sort of glide from thermal to thermal. And they can cover quite a long distance in a day, several hundred miles generally.
And while they're migrating, do they eat? And what
sure,
do they eat?
Sure, yeah. They'll stop and feed and generally on when they're migrating, they'll often stop and feed on waste corn from farms but basically cranes will eat anything. They'll eat animals and plants and snakes, anything they can find. So
they're not very picky eaters.
No, they're not. They're not.
Now, given that they're not picky eaters, it would seem that why are they endangered? Like they could find some different habitat.
That's each animal, each bird is programmed for a specific type of habitat and living condition. And this bird, it was never very populous, even before the continent was changed dramatically by settlers. So the tipping point going back to the 1800s and stuff, when this bird was hunted quite a bit, and when its habitat was literally wiped out in most of the country, there just weren't enough of them to move on and find perhaps similar habitat that they could use in other parts of North America. So it's remarkable that they did survive basically on their own until the 40s when conservationists and government officials were able to step in and start to help out. Start to spread the word about cranes and how endangered they are.
And what makes them so special? Do they have unique adaptations to their environment?
Yeah, absolutely. They're the one thing just based on their size, they have a really long getting into the anatomy a little bit, but they're getting a really long tracheal tube, and that allows them to make this extraordinary call, the unison call. That's partly where the name comes from, is hooping.
So what does the call sound like, and what's its purpose?
It's a very loud hooping sort of curlew call that I'm not even going to try to imitate here, but it can be heard for quite a long distance. And
like over kilometers or over
yeah,
miles.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is the purpose of the call? Do they use it? Is it a mating call?
It's there are several variations of their calls, and they do use the calls to stay in touch with one another. The pairs, once the pairs form, they're bonded for life, and they generally stick together. They don't go off on their own and then meet up again, you know, the next spring or something. They stay together as a pair for all their lives, and they use that call to, you know, stay in touch with each other. And then there are variations on the calls that they use to, you know, drive off intruders of other pairs. If there's a threat at the nest, you know, they obviously have a call that warns of predators and that sort of thing.
So in the wild, they live in pairs and they don't live in big groups. Is that right?
That's correct, right. Yeah, this flock that lives in Texas, they all sort of share the refuge, but it's a very large refuge, and they don't really stick together in groups. Sandhill cranes, by contrast, are much more of a species that just hangs out together, especially in winter, in large groups, especially down in, you know, Texas and New Mexico and other areas. So whooping cranes are more, they're just more somewhat loners, I guess, in a way, where they don't, the pair groups don't all get together and hang out.
And then when they migrate, they're just in pairs, or do they?
Generally in pairs. I mean, there may be a group sort of loosely moving together, but you know, I think I've heard of reports of maybe up to 8 or 10 together at during migration. But once they're generally moving on their own or as pairs, you know, together, moving by themselves.
And so this long tracheal tube lets them make this loud, weird call.
Absolutely, right. Right.
And then it lives in marshy areas. Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. They need wetlands and marsh habitats.
So are its long legs different? Can it, I guess just its size lets it go deeper in the water?
Yeah, absolutely. They can. The longer legs will allow them to get into water that, you know, smaller birds would have a lot of trouble with. So that's certainly one of their adaptations. And like I said, they'll eat anything. So their large bill allows them to basically hunt for anything that's moving around in the marsh. In Texas, one of their main winter foods is blue crabs. And that's a source that they rely on a lot for nutrition in the winter.
Hmm. And then when they're up in Canada, what do they eat?
They'll eat snakes and rodents, birds that maybe haven't fledged their nest yet, smaller birds, songbirds, and all kinds of you know, plant materials that they find in their habitat. So
that's really interesting. And then why the young ones? What's involved in the care of the young whoopers?
Young ones, they will. It's a big process because it takes about 80 days or so for a young crane to be. It's for its wings to develop enough and its feathers to develop enough that it can fly. So for those first 80 days or so, it's basically just walking around on the ground, and the parents have to keep close watch on it from passing eagles or other animals that might try to might want to eat it. So.
And how big is this baby?
I'm not entirely sure of the size, but it's fairly small and just, well, when you see pictures of them, they're just adorable. Out of the egg. Within a few weeks, they generally will start, definitely start to be a couple feet tall. And by about that 80-day period, they're, I'm not going to say full-grown, but they're definitely getting to the point where they're looking a lot like the parents. Although they're not white at that point. They have a brownish color throughout their first half of their first year.
So when did they turn white?
It's sort of gradual over the last maybe over from 6 months on, 6 months of age.
And then are they born? They're born in the spring, usually?
Generally, yeah. They're born anywhere from, I believe, from May into June is generally the time when they're born. And then the migration back to Texas begins, I believe, in October. So.
And tell me about the migration, because we're going to also talk about the experimental.
Right.
Thanks. So what all is involved in getting ready for migration and the actual process of migration?
They need to certainly build up fat reserves, like any other migratory bird, to be able to fly long distances. And so they'll certainly just put on as much fat as they can over the last few months of summer, and then flying south, it certainly takes several weeks.
I'm picturing these whooping cranes eating these ice cream cones in the no Ben and Jerry's out in the marsh,
They probably wouldn't pass it up, but.
So what do they eat for fat, for treats?
you might have me there. It's probably similar to their general diet of anything and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So
it doesn't really change. They just eat a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But one of the things that's interesting about whooping cranes is that they don't know their migration route when they hatch out as chicks. Songbirds and a lot of other species, as soon as they hatch, that's sort of innate in their brains which way to go, or which is the way to go once it's time to migrate. But cranes learn the migration route from their parents.
And that's all cranes, is that right?
Yeah, that's all cranes, yeah.
Huh.
So if something happens to the parents, then chicks are out of luck unless another pair will allow them to tag along. So
another pair will allow them.
I believe generally they might, but it's I don't know how prevalent that is in the Texas flock. It has been shown in Wisconsin that will happen.
So tell me about this Wisconsin population and what, when did Wisconsin first, you said, when you first got interested in cranes, it was in 2000 and there was
right.
a new reintroduction project just starting
right.
up then.
Right. So the, one of the goals of recovering such a small population is to have more distinct populations of the species in different places, so that if something terrible would happen to the Texas flock, there would be sort of an insurance population elsewhere that the species would not be wiped out. So the Fish and Wildlife Service and other agencies got together and decided to start a experimental population that would migrate between central Wisconsin and the Gulf Coast of Florida.
And how did they decide on Wisconsin and Florida?
Wisconsin, this particular area of central Wisconsin, has really good habitat that the cranes can use to breed in the summer. Nisida National Wildlife Refuge is in central Wisconsin, and that's the home base of the project. And then there's not only is that refuge has lots of excellent crane habitat, but the surrounding area has numbers of state wildlife areas as well as cranberry farms, which are sort of excellent crane habitat that's similar to, you know, a natural area like the refuge. And then the Gulf Coast is essentially the historic wintering range of hooking cranes. It's from all along the Gulf Coast, not just in Texas, but they were found from Florida all the way over to Mexico at one time. So getting them back to the Gulf Coast area is really sort of right in line with where these cranes should be. And
is that all along the Gulf Coast or in particular places?
There's two particular places in Florida, Chazahowitzka National Wildlife Refuge, which is a little bit north of the Tampa area, more recently, they've added a second stop in St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge, which is just south of Tallahassee. So there's two areas now on the Gulf Coast where these cranes are, this population that originates in Wisconsin, where they're spending their winters.
And how did they first get the birds into Wisconsin?
There's a story here, too. So there's about 150 or so captive whooping cranes in various places around the country, including the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center in Maryland. And that's where most of the highest number of captive birds are at. And so these captive birds breed each spring. Their eggs are taken for this project, and they are hatched in captivity. The birds that are, from the time that they're in the eggs, they do not hear human voices. They don't hear any sounds associated with people, with the exception of an ultralight aircraft. So I'll get to that in a second. But anyway, the cranes are hatched in captivity. They're raised at Patuxent for several weeks and then flown via a special aircraft to the Nisida Refuge, where they are kept in isolation and raised again without ever seeing a person or hearing a human voice.
So how do humans raise these animals initially or care for the eggs and whatnot without making a sound or without?
Yeah, they all are trained, of course, to not speak in front of the birds, and they wear white costumes that mimic the look of an adult crane, and they carry hand puppets that are carved and painted in the shape of what a adult crane looks like. So they use this hand puppet to peck at the ground, and the chicks will see the hand, the puppet, the head of the puppet, and, you know, sort of imprint on that puppet and figure out how to forage, how to find food. And that's, you know, that's the world that these young cranes are in for their first several weeks of life. And then they're conditioned to accept the sound of an ultralight aircraft because over the course of the summer, they are taught how to fly behind an ultralight, which is a small one-person airplane with a large propeller in the middle of it.
That's the plane that was used in the movie Fly Away Home.
Fly Away Home. Yes, exactly. And the same folks who taught those Canada geese to fly south in real life, and who were also involved in the making of the movie, are the people who are leading these cranes each fall south to Florida.
So, using what they learned with the Canadian geese,
right?
They now applied it to the whooping cranes.
Right, right. They tested it for 1 year on sandhill cranes just to see if this would all work, and it did. And so they got approval to go ahead with doing this with whooping cranes.
So they teach the animals how to fly behind the ultralight, not just for migration, but that's how they learn to fly or get motivated to fly as well? Is that
right. They might learn how to fly on their own just sort of as they grew older, but the point of the ultralight is that the birds do not have, obviously do not have adult parents that know a migration route. So, like I said before, they have to learn the route from their parents, and so the costumed handlers and their aircraft are basically surrogate parents that the birds accept and will fly with. So they learn this route, or they learn how to fly first of all with the crane with the ultralight plane, and then over the course of the fall, they learn the migration route from central Wisconsin down to Florida.
So what's involved for the humans? How the ultralight pilots, they're with the birds every day flying before, I mean, why will they follow this ultralight plane?
Yeah, they'll fly with it because they have learned over the course of their lives from the point that they're in the egg, up until October generally when they leave Wisconsin, that this is the way it works. You know, you come out of, you follow around, you follow the costumed handler around, and they basically imprint on these birds as their parents. I mean, I'm sorry, on the people as their parents, and so they accept that as the way of their own little world, not knowing that, you know, there's part of a grand experiment here to bring them back to the eastern part of North America. And the pilots will, between the pilots and then their staff, they are basically in charge of these birds from midsummer until they reach Florida. And that's generally the last couple of years, and this year included, is not going to be until after the first of the year. So it's a long, long process. And they're kept in a pen that's covered on the top at the Nisida Refuge for safety. And then over the course of the summer, they learn how to fly behind the ultralights.
And is the pilot the same one that's their handler earlier with a, you know, their working in the costumes with the puppets?
Yeah, it's not all the same people all the time. I mean, all the people who wear the costumes and use the puppets are all trained under the same protocol to, you know how to behave around them. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be the exact same people every single day, and certainly the people in Maryland and Patuxent are generally not the same folks who are going down south along the migration route. But yeah, in any event, they're all following the same protocol, which is very strict. You know, if they don't want any association with people at all. They want they want these cranes ultimately to be afraid of people, and when they're once they're on their own in the wild, to shy away and leave people alone. They don't want the cranes to associate people with food or with anything good. Basically, they basically just want people and anything that cars or trucks or any of that stuff. They don't really want.
So who does the training, and how do you get to be working on this project?
Right. Well, it's a lot of people, actually. There's several groups involved with the project. Operation Migration is the name of the nonprofit that is the group that flies the actual airplanes. And they're the most visible part of the project, but they'll be the first ones to tell you that they're not the only ones involved. And their Operation Migration is a fairly small group of maybe 10 people or so, four or five pilots and some support staff and operating on a shoestring budget. But the International Crane Foundation here in Wisconsin has several staff members involved in the project, Fish and Wildlife Service, and Patuxent, which is operated by the U.S. Geological Survey. They're all involved in one way or another, and there's other groups involved in this project as well. So it's certainly a big effort, and probably in any given year, 100 or more people are involved in raising each class of cranes that comes up each year.
And so what is a migration? What does a migration look like? How long does it take? You said it takes a long period of time. How long?
It'll take several months, and it's partly, it has a lot to do with the weather. Essentially, the ultralight planes cannot fly in really windy conditions for the safety of the pilots, and these cranes learn to fly behind ultralights, but they also do not necessarily fly the way whooping cranes normally fly, and that is that when they fly behind ultralights, they're pumping their wings quite a bit to keep up. And when whooping cranes are migrating, they soar, and so the amount of effort that it takes to soar, basically they hold their wings out and glide, and it's a lot less taxing on their bodies, so they can fly longer distances. So anyway, when they're flying behind the ultralight plane, it's more it takes more effort for the birds, so they can only handle maybe an hour or so each day of during the migration period. So when the weather cooperates and they get a decent day, they'll get up really early in the morning, get out at first light, lead the birds out of the pen, and get them all airborne behind the ultralights. It's a really spectacular sight. They're obviously gorgeous big birds, and they're flying behind this really interesting looking aircraft. and it's very picturesque, and lots of people will come out to see them fly over it. Generally, they have a flyover spot where people can watch. So,
can people come and visit if they're interested?
Yes, they can. They can come certainly to the Cedar Refuge in throughout the summer and look for the adult cranes on the refuge. They are around, and they can be seen during the migration itself, if you're along the route and if you're paying attention to the Operation Migration website, they'll generally say where a flyover event will happen. And they also have a big sort of, at the beginning of the migration and then at the end, they have a big flyover event, both in Wisconsin and in Florida. So lots of people generally come out for those.
Oh, interesting. And where in Wisconsin is the refuge?
It's basically right in the middle of the state, a couple hours north of Madison. So.
Have the migrations been successful?
Absolutely, yeah. They back in 2001 was the first year when they led moving cranes south, and following spring, the birds returned to Wisconsin on their own, and it's happened the same way each year since. The birds learn that route based on, you know, landmarks essentially that they see from the air as they're flying, and it's imprinted on them that that's your route. That's how you get from point A to point B in spring and fall. So then they're on their own. Essentially, they don't live with the other cranes. They don't fly with the ultralights anymore after that. They're wild birds, as wild as they can be, and they form pairs and have had some success, limited success with nesting, but in any event, it has been a very successful project.
And then how many birds are there now in this population living in Wisconsin? Traveling to Florida for the winter,
right.
The snowbirds.
Snowbirds, right. There are 85 currently in the wild, and then this year, their Operation Migration is leading another group of 20. They're currently in northern Alabama, so they're getting close, almost to Florida, but I know they've taken a little time off for the holidays. It's been kind of another slow year for migration because of the weather.
And so is that typical? Each class, each year, is about a group of 20?
That's been, I think 20 is one of the larger numbers. I think they may have had 22 or 24 one year. And I know this smaller years is somewhere more like 15 or something like that. But
and do the chicks, do they survive the migration? Because it's quite a long, difficult journey.
It is a long journey, and they've all survived just fine. I don't believe they've had any losses on the migration itself. I know this past fall, when they were still on the Nisida Refuge, they had an accident where one of the chicks was flying too close to an ultralight plane and just got too close and got entangled with the plane, and it suffered an injury that was irreversible. So they had to euthanize it. But generally they do really well on these migrations, and they similar to the over the summer. You know, they have a pen that the birds stay in, and over the summer they have a traveling pen that they set up each night at their stopover location, and so the birds are protected over the course of the day and the night while they're on the migration from any animals that may be lurking around and that sort of thing.
So recently, I know you reported about two crimes that were related to whooping cranes.
Right.
Operation Migration announced in late November that its hangar was vandalized.
Right.
And what happened there?
Yeah, so they have a hangar where they keep their ultralight planes just right next to the Nisida Refuge. After they had left for this fall's migration, they left in mid-October, someone broke in, broke the lock on the hangar, and just did an immense amount of damage.
Have they figured out what happened there or who did it?
No, they haven't. They haven't caught anybody yet in regards to that. I think there's a $3,000 reward now for information on that one. But
wow.
That's the first time anything like that has happened. And the folks at Operation Migration are just kind of blown away by it because they say they don't have any enemies. It's not a reintroduction program of a wolf or something that's a rattlesnake or some sort of animal that some people might not want around. It's like we said before, they're the birds of peace, and they're.
Except for maybe
for this
some,
to happen.
Maybe someone who just doesn't like that sound noise.
Maybe, yeah, I don't know.
And then the second crime happened in December.
An adult whooper was found shot in Indiana.
That's right. Yeah, that was quite a shock. There's this is an adult crane that was on its migration south with its, she was a female with her mate, and all these birds wear tracking devices, so they have a radio transmitter on their legs, and the folks who keep track of the birds after they're in the wild will follow them around, essentially, and keep tabs on them as best they can. And one of the people on the tracking team was on a flight, a special tracking flight in early December, flying back to Wisconsin. And she noticed that this pair, she noticed that she only found the radio signal for one of the birds in this pair. And the second bird's signal was very weak, and that was sort of a bad sign. And they sent out one of the ground trackers, and they were able to track that weak signal, but they ultimately found that the bird had been shot and left by a roadside in Indiana. And it's quite a shocking thing when you consider that there are only 530 some whooping cranes in the whole world. For one of them to be killed, but this bird in particular, to lose this one was even worse, actually, because she and her mate are the only two that have nested successfully in this eastern population. So her loss is sort of almost worse than any other crane in the group.
So they've had, she and her mate had one chick?
They had one chick. They actually hatched two in the summer of 2006. One of those birds eventually was killed by a predator, and the other one survived, and the adult pair taught their chick the route to Florida and the route back to Wisconsin. And so that proved, that these birds will nest on their own and teach their young to migrate. And that's been unfortunately has been the only successful young, basically, in the project. They've had other pairs that have laid eggs, and even a couple of that have hatched birds or hatched young chicks. But they've had some trouble with getting them beyond that point. So,
what a loss! And the person who did that.
Has not been found, no. There's a reward for information. It's $10,000 currently that if anybody has information on who did this.
Why don't they nest successfully? What have been some of the issues regarding nesting?
Nesting? They build nests. They form pairs just fine. Have their... Another fascinating aspect of looking cranes is that they have these... They dance in elaborate sort of mating rituals, raising their necks really up in the sky and raising their wings and that sort of thing, jumping around, and it's fun thing to see. Anyway, they pair up fine. They build nests. They lay eggs, and all that works. But while they're on the nest, there are some black flies on the nest, on the refuge, that swarm around the birds and cause them problems. And it's not entirely sure if the black flies drive the birds off the nest or if they're just part of the story. No one's entirely sure about that. But anyway, this coming spring, they're going to treat the waterways with a biological agent that will prevent the flies from hatching. And so with no flies to hatch this spring, hopefully the crane pairs will actually succeed with their nests and hatch some chicks. But we'll see. You know, that's the big question mark coming over the next this next spring.
So the black flies possibly cause the birds to abandon the nest after the eggs are there.
Right. It's very unusual, obviously, because and hard to understand, because there are sandhill cranes that are on the refuge. There are common loons or other, you know, larger birds, and they will nest just fine. So why the flies seem to be such a bother to the whooping cranes is, I don't know if anybody really knows the answer to that. But.
Well, I hate flies too.
Yeah, same here. Sort of understand it.
Tell me the Vermont connection with whooping cranes.
So it's basically a footnote to the story, but as I mentioned, that the birds are tracked by their radio transmitters, and one of the cranes got off course. Well, several of the cranes have gotten off course, but one in particular flew northeast, essentially, to New York State and then over to Vermont, and this was, I think, in 2005. And it was sort of off on its own, not really following the migration route that it was supposed to. And it was in Vermont. So it was in Vermont for a short time. But in the winter or fall of 04 or 05, it was captured and brought back to Florida. And it actually found a mate to pair up with, and it's now successfully part of the population and going back and forth between Wisconsin and Florida just like it should. So.
And it hasn't been back to Vermont?
No, it hasn't been back to Vermont.
Well, the fall colors are very attractive.
Well, yeah.
This little one wanted to see.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was, yeah. Or maybe it had a taste for Ben and Jerry's or something.
And it's really been a success story.
It absolutely has, yeah. There's certainly a... it's not to say that it's out of the woods. Certainly the fact that one of the birds was shot this year sort of shows that this isn't all fun and games all the time for this species. But it's definitely in a much better place than it was back in the 40s.
Well, what can listeners do to help if they're interested in helping cranes?
Well, I guess the main thing is donations. The organization like Operation Migration, International Crane Foundation, and a few others that are involved in this project are heavily reliant on donations from individuals and you know, corporations, foundations, that sort of thing. So they can certainly go to their websites and check them out. And, Operation Migration is at operationmigration.org. International Crane Foundation is at savingcranes.org.
And I'll have those links on my website and on the podcast.
Okay. And then the other one I should mention is bringbackthecranes.org, which is a website that encompasses all of this entire project in the eastern crane population, and there's a get involved link on that site, and you can find links to all the other sites, all the other organizations that are involved.
And that's a great way to end it.
Okay.
So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about whooping cranes with Matt Mendenhall, associate editor of Birders World magazine. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. You already know that it's an endangered bird that lives part of the year in the Midwest United States. It's also been the subject of this week's show. You got it yet? The sound you're about to hear again is a whooping crane. Listen and imagine you're in a swampy marsh. Next week's Creature Call, we'll stick with birds but travel to Central and South America that is the natural home of these treasured pets. Here's your preview. Be sure to tune in next week when I'll replay this strange sound from the wild world and reveal the animal that made it. Next week, I'll also talk with Tracy O'Toole, the Director of Wildlife Development Programs for Humane Society International. We'll talk about the illegal international pet trade, her job overseeing capacity building programs in Central America for wildlife law enforcement, and also her work helping establish wildlife rescue centers in Latin America.
Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com.
This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.